Hello there, everyone, and welcome to the 8th episode of Season 3 of Psyched to be with you. My guest this episode is Adam Clark. Adam is currently working in games marketing, bringing press releases to life for games, and a whole lot more. Adam was wonderful to chat to, and as such, this episode has pretty much everything you can imagine. Discussions of living in Ireland, history, games, being a carer, privilege, marketing great games, a love of bears, and so much more. Adam is really passionate about creating spaces for inclusion and access to the games industry, both locally in Ireland and for others from underrepresented groups. This episode was truly a delight, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Psyched to be with you, with me, your host, Chimble95, aka Christopher Leach. We're going to have a banging episode today. I'm very excited, adding yet to more the plethora of experience and delightful accents. It's the height of summer. It's going to be delightful. I'm excited. I hope you are as well. All that remains for me to do is pass over to you, my very special guest. If you could please tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on, Chris. My name is Adam Clark. I'm based in Ireland, but I've been working in the UK games industry just over 2 years now. I started in an agency working with a lovely team over at Game of Humor. I've since bounced between a couple of different studios as the sort of head of all things marketing. I was briefly with a studio called Oddshot Games. They make a free online game on Steam, esport game called Slapshot Rebound. Fantastic physics-based hockey game. Highly recommend checking it out if that's your bag. And most recently, I started working with a new studio called Crimson Sky Games, who make visual novels and are currently thinking about their next project, which is why they've brought me on board. So that's I suppose a wee bit of background into who I am and what I do. So thank you, and again, thank you very much for having me. Very excited to be a guest, Chris.
Not a problem. I do feel like, not to crack open a broader political nutshell, but for international listeners, Ireland is different to the UK. I feel that's important to kind of reinforce.
I'm glad you said it, because I sometimes worry. I'm like, am I banging that drum a bit too hard? But it's more than once in the industry, someone will say like, oh, you're in Ireland, so you know you're in the UK, or oh, I know someone in Northern Ireland, so you must know them. And I'm like, it's a whole thing. There's a history there, you know. I remember I was speaking to a friend of mine. I actually did live and work in the UK. And I had a coworker from China, and he asked about it, and he said, oh, so you're like English? And I'm like, no. It's a whole different thing. And the best example I could think for him, because obviously, you know, people assuming you're from a different nationality or whatever, I gave him the example. I was like, look, respectfully, would be like me saying, oh, you're Japanese or whatever, which ended up being quite apt because there's a whole history between those two countries specifically as well. And he was like, ah, I get it. Say no more. Yeah, no, totally fine.
But my go-to is like, you know, the way North and South Korea are different countries.
Fairly solid together. Example. That being said, I will say, at least between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland these days, I mean, obviously there's the peace process. Things are a lot better than they were. Obviously, there's always still progress to be made. There's still issues there, but I find I'm quite comfortable. You know, going up to the north of Ireland, it's a much different picture than it was, you know, only a couple of decades ago. And I have great friends over in the north of Ireland, great colleagues as well. So it's, you know, we've made a lot of progress, still a lot more to go. But I'm glad to be part of a generation where things are looking much more positive. So that's fantastic. As before I was in the world of marketing, my undergrad was in English and history. So I'm very quick to like just disappear talking about history. You'll have to forgive me.
No, I mean, I love to see it. Getting straight into the real issues, like, just boom, psyched to be with you. So the history, like, let's, you know what I mean? I just think, you know, the world's fascinating, and my loose sort of, not view, but like, I kind of always frame it in the context of, I always say I'm Scouse, not English. There's the whole, like, Liverpool being, like, in the UK, but not of it, and sort of those type of sort of things.
Forgive me if I'm misunderstanding. I think Liverpool has a lot of like it actually has a lot of like Irish heritage as a city.
Yeah, well, being sort of like a sort of dock, you know, sort of dock-based city, very working class,
Exactly,
very
yeah.
liberal. It's very unique, but it very much like we have a very solid individual identity here. I mean, it's very rooted in political and sort of even like geographical kind of leanings with the way like the, you know, the UK is run, particularly England is run. But yeah, like we always like feel separate to it, and you know, we typically tend to get on with other sort of working class kind of like towns and cities very much. But yeah, it's really interesting just to think about like how we feel in the places that we are.
Yeah, that's very true. I suppose like with Ireland, you have different opinions per county based on like how people feel like things about government and whatever, but it's interesting because I suppose to sort of stray, as you say, like having political differences and all the rest of it, our governments tend to be relatively conservative, but our like general populace is actually quite liberal, quite like left-leaning as a country. Like we're my understanding is like we're one of the only countries in the world that have like legalized bodily autonomy and same-sex marriage by like public vote. So like that was a direct change to our oh God, what's the term? The document that defines you as a country, the not quite our Declaration of Independence. The word has just jumped out of my head. But yeah, so like those are enshrined, constitution, that's the word.
There we go.
Those are now enshrined in our constitution. They can't just be overturned on a whim, which is reassuring, especially when you've seen I suppose the general direction the world is going in. Like you hear stories coming over from America where they're making loads of like rollbacks against areas where they've been quite progressive in the past. So, because they're not enshrined in the constitution, so at least Ireland going forward will have some measure of protection against stuff like that. But I say that as a relatively liberal person, I suppose I'll own up to that right away. But this seems like a space that will encourage that, to be perfectly candid. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I feel like because you know, for listeners, obviously we were having a bit of a chat before we sort of press record, and we're just chatting away. Love to see it. It's why I love doing this show. But let's talk more about what you do, marketing. What's that for the folks at home that don't know? What does that involve? Because I feel like maybe particularly in games, but like a lot of roles can go by different names, but are quintessentially the same thing.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair point. And in the games industry, I suppose marketing can be one of those more nebulous ones. I have it as a point of pride. It's not technically true anymore, but when I was first beginning my marketing journey, one of my like bragging points to like when I was in the agency and I was meeting with clients left, right, and center was, look, I don't know a single line of programming code, and that's great for you. And that would throw them off, and I'd be there going, well, like, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, like, I have a better understanding, I suppose, of people who are going to be playing your games who don't write code, who don't know all those background processes that are going to make the game, you know, this unique, wonderful project that it is. So I'm going to be able to more easily adapt the mindset of what people are going to look for in your game, what's going to stand out in your game to them and capture their attention. So marketing, I suppose, it makes up a lot of different things in the games industry. It can be a very active process, like, you know, organizing and running campaigns. So say, for example, like just to throw, I was only speaking to someone I know who works over at Larian Studios the other day about it, but Baldur's Gate 3 coming out next week. It's in early access at the minute. Marketing campaign for that has absolutely exploded in popularity. It's been obviously that was arranged and coordinated quite carefully. A lot of planning was gone into that, but I mean, straight out the gate, the thing that blew everything up was, oh, you have a romance scene with a druid who can wild shape, because it's all based on like the Dungeons and Dragons sort of mythos. You can romance a druid that can wild shape into a bear, and in the romance scene with him, you can encourage him to go into bear form and stay in bear form for the duration of the romantic encounter. And that exploded online because, like, I mean, it's different. It's as far as like game romance scenes go, well, out there, it's different. It's sort of playing around with, I guess, modern, you know, discussions around like furry culture and all that kind of thing. So it got people talking, it got people interested in looking at the game. And from there was a sort of audience-led discussion of like all these early reviews of Baldur's Gate 3 coming in going, oh my goodness, this game is an amazing piece of art. And then like they started getting free marketing from other development studios coming in going, this shouldn't be considered like the standard of game development. This should be considered like an exception, you know, that the game is this good. And they're almost sort of outing themselves a little bit of, we're not able to make a game as good as this. So I guess marketing, to sum it all up, it's kind of getting that ball rolling, that snowball started, getting people excited for projects and figuring out why it is that it's going to capture their attention and get them interested. And my background is primarily in research. And then I always pride myself, I suppose, on being an extroverted researcher. I love going off and studying for hours, putting documentation together. But I also love talking to people and getting excited about video games. I'm a diehard gamer. So marketing really naturally called to me because it's sort of the meeting point of those two things. It's very research heavy. You're trying to figure out, who is this game for? How do we get them excited about it? And then it's the communications aspect of going out and telling people about the game and working with influencers, working with news outlets, getting the word out there, organizing like streams and all that kind of thing. It's simultaneously lets me go off and do research, but also lets me flex my creative muscles. So as a from a career point of view, it's just a very exciting field of work for me. I just genuinely really enjoy the art of marketing. And there's a bit of data in there as well. As I mentioned, when I first started in the industry, I didn't know a lick of code. But on the side, I have a real passion for data. We were talking about this, you're doing a PhD. We were talking about this at Develop Brighton. I love data science, working with like facts and figures. And that comes from, I suppose, when I was doing my master's in marketing, I'd gone in for the creative end of things, but I had a fantastic lecturer, Dr. Denise Earle, who's got like a PhD, a doctorate in statistics. And she taught me all about data science and how to work with facts and figures and basically how to use that to help with your marketing. So obviously there was that angle to it, but I was blown away by like working with data and what you can do. So since then, I've been working on data science sort of on the side, just building up my own understanding, learning of it. I find it fascinating and directly applicable, very helpful for marketing as well. But anyway, yeah, so I guess I've sort of gone. The work that I do.
And I think it's really interesting as well because, you know, I feel like when people maybe hear of marketing or sort of like almost, and I don't like the title, but, you know, Mad Men, this advertisement agency kind of like, you know, you're the person taking people out for dinner. I mean, like, come on, you want us to market your game, you know, that type of thing. But like, it is much more like, yeah, I'm going to go away, I'm going to get some data and produce a report and be like, well, actually, we've seen this. And obviously, you know, I do psychology. I think one of the beautiful things about the digital age that we're in is that we have access to all this data. We're always generating data. Like, you know, if you have a mobile phone and you carry it with you, you're generating data. It's pinging off things. Mm. Like, it's impossible to run from it, you know? And it's really interesting to see, like, how those data points marry up to activity, particularly when you think about, you know, psychology, again, my background, but, like, behavior change, what actually prompts someone to go from not being interested in a product or game and then actually buying it, you know, like, how do we create that shift? And I think that's really interesting. Going back to the Baldur's Gate example, I remember the various news reports of, you can F a bear, like, I remember when that happened. And I think that's really interesting in the context of, I've had discussions on this show before around how you know, games can sometimes to, oh, we provide you all the romance options in finger quotes, but like, to be, I don't know, homosexual, that'd be buried within 20 like dialogue options. And my guest at the time pointed to Witcher 3. It's like, you can have, you know, homosexual romance in that, but it's like 20 quests down the line and it's like one button and you have to go looking for it.
I didn't even know that, so that's your point very well made.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of like, it perhaps demonstrates some level of growth. It's like, yeah, you can romance whom and whatever you want, however you want.
Mm, exactly, yeah. It's a nice sort of, I think romance in games has come a long way. It used to be quite I suppose, bare bones. But it comes, I guess, with being a creative industry where you're going to have creative people working on these things instead of challenging the norms. I remember as the king of privilege, as a straight white man, I remember playing Dragon Age Inquisition and going into it and loving the characters and being just blown away. Like BioWare, I'll always give them credit, especially with Inquisition, but across all their titles as well. They went in with like LGBT awareness and inclusion from the jump. Like they had those options since Dragon Age Origins, but in Dragon Age Inquisition, I was there like, man, and I don't mean this in a bad way. I was like, man, it is harder to find like straight characters than it is to find characters that are like bisexual or, gay or whatever the case may be. Like there's trans inclusion and everything. It's just fantastic representation in that game. And as I said, I don't say that in a bad way. Like my humble little male dwarf, because I love dwarves, he hopped in the game. He found a partner, he went and off and he was happy, and I was exploring all those romances and the diversity and the options that they have, and it's fantastic. We've come a long way in games, and I think in terms of media and all the rest of it, obviously film is very important, but I think games are a really driving point for discussion around those topics as well, particularly because there's such every time you roll out a game that has anything in the realm of diversity, there's such a big flood of people coming in going, oh, we don't need this, game shouldn't be political and blah blah blah. And that argument never sits well with me because I'm like, never mind games, just art is inherently political,
Yes,
you know?
exactly. Like I
You
was
can't.
literally having this discussion yesterday, and I was talking about how, like, Nick Cave, the musician, he says that like art should challenge your perspectives, otherwise is it really art? And I'm like, well,
Absolutely.
exactly the point. Like, if I'm a big football fan, being from Liverpool, big surprise, and you get this whole, oh, football shouldn't be political, and I'm like, it is, but it inherently is though. Every because in everything is inherently political. So you either can
Exactly.
accept it and then operate within that, or try and pretend that it's not. I mean, like, even every game that pits one side against the other is political, because you're the
Exactly.
hero taking down the evil empire. Like, you if you frame the game from the other perspective, you'd be defending yourself against essentially a terrorist. And
Exactly.
like, it's maybe that perspective that people don't get as much, because it's framed in this whimsical monsters and good guys and bad guys.
That's it. I think when I hear someone say, oh, whatever, X is too political for me or whatever, what I generally hear back is, I don't like to be challenged. And I mean, granted, it's not 100% hit rate, but like 9 times out of 10, when I meet someone who's like, oh, I don't like this game, it's woke or it's this or that, I'm like, you look and have the same preferences as me, as in a straight white dude, who's never been challenged in his life. Like I actively go out and, I try to expand my knowledge and my horizons. And, I'd like to think of myself a very open-minded person. And then I meet people who are like, oh, this game is, I'm not going to touch it. It's got like gay characters in it or whatever. I'm just like, okay, I know everything I need to know about you. You are not going to contribute to any discussion meaningfully because you've got your mind made up about what your views are. You're calling it non-political, but it is inherently political and you're kind of just ignorant. And that's the end of it. You don't want to progress that discussion any further. So,
I
like, I
think
mean,
in
oh,
like
sorry, go
today's
on.
like algorithmic, if that's algorithmic world, I think it's obviously very easy to fall into an echo chamber, right? And I think, even with the way we access, I mean, like, we could have a whole different discussion about book censorship and
Oh,
rewriting
God, yeah.
history and stuff. And I say this as, someone who was born in England, where we teach that we were the good guys and colonialism wasn't evil. Colonialism was
Oh
very
my
evil.
goodness.
We were the bad
I
guys.
if I can interrupt you briefly, like when I, as I said, I lived in Loughborough for a year working as an engineer. I have a really weird career history. I won't get into it here. But at one point in time I was an engineer. The thing that blew my mind, because I assumed like Ireland is right beside England, like those living experiences wouldn't be too dissimilar. Everyone will have different accents, but and like that lived experience, it was relatively similar, but like there were enough differences that I was like, I feel like the other in this country, I feel a little bit outside of the loop a little bit. And when I like established friend groups and talked about history and all the rest of it, it blew my mind that like the norm is just, oh yeah, no, like we did that, and you know, we brought over and we helped these people. I'm like, that is not how it's taught in our country, believe me. Like in Ireland, it was like the English came over and they took this, and they, you know, and then there was the Ulster plantations and this, that, and the other thing. It's a much more, I guess, raw. I don't want to use the word like accurate, because I guess history is always, it's one of those things always up for discussion, up for debate. But it's a very different picture to how it's taught in the UK. And I remember I had a wonderful friend. He was a scrum manager or something. That always sounds like a rugby term to me, but scrum lead or something like that. And I got on very well with him because he was like, "Oh yeah, I'm a real big history buff. I went off and, you know, learned my own history, and it's so different to what they teach us in school." And I'm like, "There you go, a fella taking an active interest in like this, in learning and studying history." But then him coming back to me and going like, "We teach it so poorly in schools. It's so like colored in favor of your country's history." And now I can't go saying like, oh, England is bad for that. I imagine every country does that to some extent, because you know, it's just it I guess it's the done thing to try to think positively of your country and its history and all that kind of thing. I'm not exactly an educational theorist or anything like that, but even still, it's why it's so important, I guess, to meet people from other cultures and have those conversations. And again, it just comes back to, I don't like when people are afraid of challenging themselves, which is ironic because they maintain that they're the people challenging people by like standing against like trans rights and stuff like that. No, you're not challenging anyone. You're just sort of being a dick, but I digress.
No, I mean, I'm actually I'm blessed to have quite a few friends who are historians, and like one of the things that, you know, sort of comes through those chats is like, yeah, there'll be like this battle and both sides will say they won, so we don't know who won. Like,
And that's really the end of
and that's history in a nutshell, fam. Like, you know, it's all about context, isn't it? And I think it's about how well we can readjust that, because I think you are in danger, because if you just pretend all the bad things didn't happen, I think you're in danger of like allowing that to then come back at something out a bit else, a bit more monstrous. You're almost like giving it more energy. Whereas if you go, okay, we accept this happened, we cannot celebrate it, we cannot cheer it. I mean, you know, again, like to root this in a local example, Liverpool fans booed the national anthem at Wembley. And people got upset by that, and it's like, well, no, because we celebrated someone sitting on a throne in gold while people can't afford to eat. We disagree with that as a group of people, as a collective. So we don't support this national idea, and it that's because it's not about just saying, oh well, this is so simplistic of yes or no, good or evil, right? And even then, that's perspective, subjective philosophical terms. I do a PhD. So like it truly is about like, okay, well, let's accept what happened and then change, not celebrate and grow, not just erase. I think that's where it can become a problem. Like, again, like, you know, I remember being taught World War II in school and just being like, so we were the good guys, and we did all this good stuff. That's it.
There
No,
you go.
no nuance to that at all. And there's
No,
lots of
like
nuance.
Irish history now, I suppose, to be fair, as you mentioned, you know, the examples of battles or whatever, I will say, maybe somewhat comically, Irish history, anything involving England, like 9 times out of 10, it's like, oh man, we got beaten by those guys. They put us down. But then like that's why we, like most of our stuff is like rebellions and risings, because you know, we're fighting the power. But like Ireland isn't immune to that as well. Like I remember learning in history in school that we, you know, it's like, oh yeah, no, Ireland was neutral, but you know, people volunteered and would go and, you know, join up with the English army to fight in the war and yada yada. And that's what's taught in school. And then you learn, yeah, there were Irish people who went and fought on behalf of Germany as well, but we're not as quick to admit that, because it was like they were people who were very driven by, I don't care what's going on in global politics, I just really don't like the English, sort of the mentality. But because I mean, we've got other exa well, not actually, to be fair, Ireland, I guess historically, we've always, because we've been the underdog ourselves a lot of the time, we'll tend to side with underdogs. Like Germany, I'm not saying Germany is the underdog in World War II. I'm going to a different example here. That was its own piece. That's me saying, yeah, like even Ireland isn't immune to that, where people would think, you know, we're quite open about teaching history because we've been on, I guess, the losing end a lot of the time. No, we've done stuff too, and I think it's very important to acknowledge that. Like there was beef in the past between the United States and Mexico, like early on, like in terms of territory. And the United States like got troops, military regiments brought over that were Irish. And they came in, they saw the situation. Okay, so you're the big guy trying to take land from the Mexicans. Right. So we're going to fight on Mexico's side. We're going to turn traitor here and fight on their side. So it's interesting where you'll be surprised how many like positive relations Ireland has with countries because we fought alongside with them against the oppressors who were usually like the US or the UK. And yet, surprisingly, thankfully, we tend to have quite good relationships with those countries as well. Ireland, hard not to like Ireland, I found it, from a historical context, at least. Everyone seems to get along with us. But I mean, it's like Mac and It's Always Sunny. It's almost a little bit like I play both sides so that I always come out on top. You know, it's almost a little bit like that. But anyway, we're getting very bogged down in history. As I said, I'll go off on tangents talking about it.
Just one of the reasons I love doing this show. You know what I mean? Just I love it. I love having this
I'm
type of
psyched about
discussion.
history. What can I say? There you go.
Hey, did the thing. To dial back though, let's reel back a little bit. Games marketing. You mentioned already. You kind of went down a more academic route. How did you find then sort of I'm going to say maneuvering, but maneuvering into the industry? Because I think a lot of people, myself included, up until recently, have kind of thought that the games industry is this kind of or the universe you need a rocket to get to, or a time machine or something. So can you talk about like navigating into the space?
To get into. People ask me how did I get into the industry, and I'm just like, oh man, blind luck really is how I got in. And like that's because you know I have a lot of passion for video games, and we can absolutely talk a bit more about that. But like however hard it is to get into the games industry in the UK, it's just not something talked about in Ireland. Like there are people who play video games or whatever, but it's just the numbers aren't there compared to other countries. So for me getting into the games industry, there was that additional layer of challenge where you just don't have any connections or resources or anything like that. Now, the picture is starting to change. Like there are game studios in Ireland. There's a couple of AAA studios. As I said, Larian Studios is in Dublin. I think EA has an office over in Galway. And then one of my like favorite little tidbits about Ireland is John Romero lives in Galway as well with his wife and like just has Romero Games studios up and going. So like this prolific guy in the world of video games history. He's just chilling out in Galway somewhere, you know, doing his thing, minding his business. So that scene is starting to change, and I'm hoping that's a trend that continues. One of my like stated goals while I work in the games industry is to like boost Ireland's profile and to like, I guess, get Ireland more excited about working with video games because it just has so much potential. We're a very tech-driven country, so it just makes like natural sense. But anyway, yeah. So navigating into the games industry, I think weirdly was probably helped by the COVID-19 pandemic in some senses because being opened or becoming open to remote work was a lot more common as a result of that. Like people expanded their horizons and whatnot. And if I wanted to work in the games industry, I reckon before COVID, it would have been expected of me to move to the UK to accommodate that. I've got a sibling with special needs, so I prefer to stay in Ireland to be able to like help support looking after her. So it's sort of kind of torn between two worlds. But as a result of people having those discussions about like remote work and whatever, my horizons opened up a little bit more. So I started applying for jobs in the UK. There are like agreements that allow Irish people to work remotely in the UK, but now obviously people were more willing to have those discussions about making that a reality. So that was just me. I applied for jobs left, right, and center. I finished my master's degree. I did a brief stint in politics, again, weird career history. And after that, I was just applying for games jobs left, right, and center because I was just so passionate about the field and I really wanted to work in it. And eventually, like it took some doing, but eventually, the games in or the video game marketing agency Game If You Are reached out to me. I did an interview with them, and that's how I got in. And that's why I say it's blind luck. You know, I was one of a few different candidates interviewed. I was lucky to be offered a job. It was a great company, great team. But like, I mean, it's a hard industry to get into. There's no secret about that. Like, you have to, it really helps to know someone, to have those connections and have those relationships. But I mean, it's not too dissimilar from any other industry in that respect. I mean, just in terms of finding jobs, finding work, like, again, I've worked at a bunch of different industries, a bunch of different sectors, not always doing marketing. But if you want to, like, if you're targeting something in particular, that immediately gets about 80% easier, I nearly reckon, because this, I think they say 80% of jobs in any given industry aren't publicly advertised. It helps immensely to know someone who can, like, either mentor you or, like, put a good word in for you in terms of, like, you know, hiring and all that kind of thing. I think we need to acknowledge in the games industry that it's a very privileged industry to be a part of. It's not without its imperfections. There are definitely issues within the industry that need to be discussed and addressed. But in terms of people entering into the industry, a lot of the time it's due to, like, support and existing connections. I'm very big on seeing more people from, like, minority backgrounds or disadvantaged backgrounds getting more involved in games, which is why I'm so big on, like, boosting the games industry in Ireland and, like, being able to accommodate for that. And it's something that needs to happen more in the UK as well. And I think it is great to see, like, I was at Develop Brighton, and it's wonderful to see that we're definitely moving in the direction of more diversity. But that needs to be backed up with, you know, let's make sure, you know, diversity is all well and good, but if you're all from, like, relatively well-to-do backgrounds, you know, we're not having the voices of disenfranchised people heard. That needs to be accounted for more. Like, I come from, like, a farm countryside background. It was quite hard to get into games. Sorry, Chris, you look desperate today.
So this is a really, really important point, and I think it maybe doesn't necessarily get included. And I'm going to phrase this delicately, but I think the way business views diversity often is like, oh, we'll get someone else from another red brick university that has a first class degree. And I found that what happens is those people all still share the same political, ideological views.
Yes.
So there is no actual diversity of ideas. And that's what diversity truly should be, right? It's bring people in from different areas to help bring different ideas. And if all those people have the same values and views, you're not actually getting that. You're just essentially box ticking. And that's where it falls down.
Exactly.
And this is where we can sort of loop, soup, and pull here a little bit, because that brings us to kind of our mutual connection, Annie. You know, they actually recently launched Social Link, which is designed to open up this discussion. And we had a great chat about being working class and trying to get into the gaming industry and the additional barriers. And I can say, I think for the first time on the show, like, I'm part of Impact celebrating disability and neurodiversity in the games industry, because there is not enough representation and not enough advocacy, right? And it is really, we are in such a great point to see these initiatives happening, and it's about how do we then push that through. And I think, as you point out, connections, like, that's how I was at Develop Brighton, through Impact. You know, with Many Cats, you part of Yuki's Raise the Game pledge. Got to get the buzzwords in, the hashtags, hashtag We Are Impact. But, like, I think having these collectives, even online initially, helps push forward that physical space and then those connections, and then we will by hook or by crook, pull more diversity into the industry.
Absolutely. And I feel it's an important point to come in. I remember, hands held up, I only learned about the existence of the book, but so I actually need to go and read it. But the concept of it, I was like, that is something that hits me so profoundly. And you'll have to forgive me, I can't remember the author's name, but they have a premise basically that they call Race to the Margins, which is where people from relatively privileged backgrounds, and, like, I mean, I imagine this happens in gaming. I don't think I've encountered it, but I mean, it's representative of any industry. It's a practice called Race to the Margins, where, say, like, take, for example, me. Again, as I said, it's a running joke. I harp on about it all the time. I'm as privileged as you can come. I come from I would say, upper middle class background, live in the Irish countryside. Like, I'm white, I'm straight, like, just a tick box exercise of privilege. I worked in student politics for a couple of years, where I became very aware of how lucky I was, I suppose, to have those privileges and all the rest of it. And as I said, the race to the margin is when you're from a background like mine, where you're generally well off. Now, again, as I said, games industry relatively hard to get into for Irish people. But for the most part, I've had it pretty good, all things considered. But the race to the margin is basically the practice of when you're from a background like mine, trying to clasp onto something and being like, oh, no, no, like as I'm Irish or whatever, you know, or in my case, like I'm a carer or whatever, trying to find stuff to make yourself a victim in some way, shape or form so that you can justify your own existence in an industry or like having certain benefits that other people have or whatever. And I think an important part of how we continue to move forward is people being able to, I guess, address and accept their own privilege and use it positively to help like bring people who don't have those same advantages as you into these spaces. Like, so I'll hold my hands up and go, oh, yeah, no, king of privilege. That's why I joke about it all the time. Very fortunate background. Arguments could be made, but I prefer not to make them. It's like, no, like, I mean, like just looking at me surface level, I have a lot of advantages in like job interviews and stuff that maybe other people wouldn't be so lucky to get. So I try to stray away from saying I have any disadvantages or anything like that. I think all things considered, I've been quite lucky to be dealt the hand that I've been dealt. And it's important to acknowledge that and use that to platform people who don't have those same advantages and try to bring them up. So I would say it's another reason I love marketing so much. I went in initially, my interest in marketing was I wanted to be like, I was young, I wanted to be a YouTuber, content creator, all that kind of thing. As I learned about the practice and wanted to do it more, I was like, this is a great vehicle to platform the people whose voices need to be heard, who get involved in those conversations. So I actually kind of, it's ironic now that I'm on a podcast publicly and talking to you about it, but I love kind of being in the background and showcasing other people, which is why like Social Link is such a fantastic thing. Annie's put incredible work into it. And I'm just delighted to be in the background. Like I play a small part in the team, you know, I handle their social media and everything, but I'm like, that's just, it's where I want to be, just in the background, like showcasing the great work that our wonderful team is doing and making sure that people from these disenfranchised backgrounds have the opportunity to get involved in the games industry. Because I want to see the games that those people make, you know?
Now, if I can probe though, I'm interested because I worked in outreach in academia for a while about, you know, sort of student engagement and retainment and things. And people from care leaver backgrounds who were either, you know, from care situations or were active carers, they are considered a marginalized group. There's not enough voices of people of those backgrounds and those experiences. I'm interested because, like, obviously, you know, you're joking about being the king of privilege, but and it's not like it's not shall we say a complete counterbalancing act. But I'm interested to hear that, like, you also are engaged in sort of a care-related experience. Like, you know, that to say, would you, like, to say that hasn't impacted your experience at all would be dismissive? Question mark?
That's, you know, it's a very fair point. And, I don't hide it. I am very open about it because, like, I mean, if I'm in a job interview and they say, is there anything you should be aware of? I go, yeah, I'm a carer outside of when I work, you know, so that can sometimes eat into my commitments to work. And like, I don't make any secret about it. Work is a job. My family is my life, you know, that kind of thing. I'm very, it's funny. I don't want kids, but I'm very family driven. My sister is like the most, yeah, there you go. It's not as uncommon as I thought, but my sister is like the most important thing in the world to me. She was born with a learning disability. So like it takes her a bit longer to grasp concepts. She sort of mentally ages a little bit slower than everyone else. It's funny because I joke now she is like, she's my older sister, which people tend not to assume because I look like I'm 40 and I'm 29.
You say to the guy with the white hair and white beard.
Fair point. Yeah. Not really thinking about my audience there, but, so my older sister, slower to grasp concepts and all the rest of it, I would say she's mentally kind of, I like to joke now, she's entered her sort of edgy teen phase where she's where I was when I was like 15 or 16, where I was staying up till 2 a.m. every morning playing video games, hanging out with like my online buddies and all that kind of thing. And she's in her 30s and she's starting to encounter that. But that's less to do with her age and anything. And it's more just about how accessible like the games community space has become. Discord has been fantastic for my sister, like developing friendships outside of the world of special needs, which has been, it's done my heart so good that she has friends she'll like hop on and play Final Fantasy 14 with, and like they'll have their running jokes, they'll have their community nights and play these games, and just I hear her laughing in the late hours of the night when I'm trying to sleep, but I'm not even mad because I'm just like, she's happy, and you know, she's got friends. She has wonderful resources locally in town as well, where like she, as I said to you before I jumped on the podcast, I had to bring her into her care center where she interacts with like people who are trained in looking after people with special needs. And that's why I love comic cons and stuff like that as well, because she goes and she wears like her Pokemon thing. She's a massive Pokemon fan. She'll wear bits from Pokemon, from Final Fantasy or whatever, and she'll talk to people about those interests. And their first impression of her isn't, this is someone with special needs. This is someone who is super excited about Pokemon or Final Fantasy or all that kind of thing. So it's just wonderful to have those spaces. But anyway, sorry, to get back to your question, I think me being a carer has definitely impacted, it definitely me as a person, I guess, because I guess if I didn't have those, I don't know what kind of person I'd be. Like, I grew up in a house full of women. My dad used to travel for work all the time. So I'm quite like emotionally geared. I like to consider myself relatively emotionally intelligent. Obviously, that's not me trying to brag or anything. I think it's just, it's one of the few types of intelligence I can attribute myself to. I like to think I'm sensitive to how people feel. And I like to think I'm good at getting people engaged and feeling happy and involved, which is great for marketing, but more and more interesting about it as a personal level. I think being a carer has impacted me where, as I said, I don't shy away from it, but I'm also conscious of it. So when I see people in the space in Twitter and stuff talking about, you know, maybe struggling with things like ADHD or autism or stuff like that, I think I'm a bit more empathetic to it. It's an experience I can connect with somewhat indirectly as being someone who looks after my sister who goes through those kind of struggles and all the rest of it. So I think maybe compared to other people who might be in the position that I'm in who aren't carers, maybe I'm a bit more empathetic. I don't want to say that with certainty, because obviously there are probably going to be people who are going to be empathetic regardless. But in terms of, I guess, how it colors me and how I interact with people, I think it did, overall, to put a pin on it, I think it definitely makes me a lot more patient with people who might be difficult or they might be a bit slow to get their thoughts out. I like to think I'm good at interacting with those people and giving them the space they need to vocalize their thoughts, whether it's a client or someone else in the games industry or all that kind of thing. That is, if they can find a space to talk within like the 5 minute, like the soliloquies I go on whenever anyone asks me a question. But yeah, I think that answers your question, unless you want to probe a bit further.
So I think what I'm hearing from this, though, I think is that you mentioned, like, you know, you've kind of had this myriad of careers and sort of jobs and stuff on the journey. And you know, you're in games because games are important, and you touch on your sister playing games as well. I mean, like, this sort of, you know, ties it in, but obviously you mentioned you're an avid gamer. Like, how much of, you know, enjoying games in a social capacity informed you then wanting to work in games?
Yeah, it was really one of the driving factors. Like, you know, I heard the phrase as a kid, you know, do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. That is an absolute lie. But that is nonetheless what colored me into wanting to work in video games, particularly, again, because it's just not something that's very well known in Ireland. I recall a conversation with a colleague back in my politics days where we were talking about our weekends. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, I got my sister's Nintendo Switch and I managed to like crack open the Joy-Con and replace the analog stick, you know, fix the Joy-Con drift she was having and whatever. And my colleague just went, oh, good for you. I have no idea what a Nintendo Switch is. So just to give you cuts, like, it's more normal to not really know about video games and the like in Ireland. I think while I say that, that might have been a very extreme example. But I have been playing video games since I was like 2 years old. I like to joke I was holding a controller before I was able to walk, because my dad would have his Atari in the sitting room and I'd be sitting there playing like Judge Dredd or something. Definitely not something a 2-year-old should have been playing, but I mean, I didn't know what was going on. I was running around making the pretty colors come up on the screen and beating up cars in Street Fighter, as one does. But yeah, so I've always had a really strong passion for video games. And then video games sort of being the vehicle with which my sister kind of experiences the world and connects with the world, that's obviously been very important for me as well, which is why I guess I want to, or it's what kind of pushed me all the harder to get working in video games. Because when I was doing my master's degree, I was like, yeah, I could really do marketing in any field. You know, it's an exciting practice. I enjoy the work less so than the industry that I work in. But then, you know, it's that personal level of having that familial value of the importance of video games, at least among my siblings. My parents don't really care about video games, but I guess because they're so important to my sister, I'm like, I'd love to be a part of the industry that makes her so happy. And like, it's come up in a couple of things now where my sister would be like, oh, have you heard of this game coming out? Because my sister is on top of games news, probably more than I am a lot of the time. She'd be like, oh, have you heard this game coming out? And I'll be like, heard of it? Like, I know the people making it, or I've actually done a bit of PR for it, or whatever that case kind of thing, which is always exciting. So it's another, I guess, route to connect with my sister and like build my relationship with her, which makes me very happy. So ideally, I'll have like a long and fruitful career in video games because, as I said, I want to boost the games industry in Ireland, but also it's very, it has a lot of emotional significance for me, both in terms of my personal enjoyment of them, but also like with my relationship with my sister. And then like I've made great friends through video games as well. Like video games have contributed positively a lot in my life, and I guess it's just me wanting to be a part of that process and to give back in some way, shape, or form. And obviously, as we've said, like I think the more I work in games, the more I realize I think my role within that is going to be bringing, try doing, using my advantages to bring in disenfranchised people and get them involved in the video games industry and just make it a more accessible space for everyone.
And I think so. I'm kind of interested then, what would you say is one of your sort of crowning achievements at the moment? Like, I understand you're like with upcoming projects, NDAs, and all these type of things. But if I were to ask you for like what is something that you like, one of those moments where you can say, oh, I know the people working on that, and that sort of brought joy to your household. Have you got kind of like one of those moments that you could share?
We are back when I was in the agency, we were partnered with this fantastic studio, Armor Game Studios. My sister really got caught up with a game called The Spirit and the Mouse, which is this game, you're a mouse set in France. It's set in France. It's by a French studio. Art is absolutely gorgeous on it, and it's this wonderful little sort of wholesome story of a mouse in France who is trying their best to help everyone through the night. Like, someone's power goes out, and this mouse is like, oh, I'm going to go figure out how to fix their power and all that kind of thing. And it's a very wholesome, very sweet little game, great studio, great publisher. And my sister, completely independently of the work that I do, she came up to me and she said, oh, have you heard of, The Spirit and the Mouse, coming out on like Steam and Switch and all the rest of it? And I went, heard of it? I'm the one who wrote the press release. I'm the one who did all the PR for it. So it was little things like that. So that was a fun one for particular for me and my sister. And that game, I don't work on it anymore, obviously. It continues to do well. I think they've announced they're coming to PlayStation. So like, it's so great to see them go from strength to strength because it's such a great little game. And then in the same vein, also Armor Game Studios, I was involved with the PR on a game called Bear and Breakfast, where you're a bear that runs a bed and breakfast. And it's just a fun little cozy sort of management sim game. It's got a really great story. The art style is fantastic. Again, great studio when I spoke with them, and it was Armor Games as their publisher again. But I am a self professed fan of bears. They're like my favorite animal. So I have to be very careful with how I word that now with all the latest talk about Baldur's
Especially,
Gate.
yeah, especially with that before, like.
Exactly. So, like I was speaking to my friend who works at Larian Studios, like, oh, I'm delighted because I love bears. Oh my God, but not like that,
And
so
that's
like
the
bears are
clip
my
we're going to use for
jam.
promo of the episode, guys.
That works for me. Go for it. But bears are like my favorite animal. So like for me, working on Bear and Breakfast was a really fun project. And then that just did really well. It was like one of the top selling games on Steam when it launched. So it was great to see it do so well as an indie title to get that much profile, that much attention. Like I did PR for it. I cannot take credit for the amount of work that went to that game because I came into it quite late. Like, so they'd already been doing marketing. Armor had been helping the studio out with it. So they'd been knocking it out of the park before I showed up. I worked with the agency to do the PR bits. We were handling keys and talking to journalists and to influencers and all that kind of thing and arranging those pieces. And that was, it was very busy time, but I still look back at that now as being sort of one of my crowning achievements. It's like, yeah, I was involved with the PR of Bear and Breakfast, and it released a great success. And I'm just like, yeah. So like professionally, it went great. I'm delighted with that. And then personally, I'm like, I was involved with a game that had bears as like the main character. So I'm very happy. I love bears. But yeah, those are a couple of examples, I suppose, of my job going particularly well.
No, that's good. I think I'm also interested in, like, just, what have you been playing lately? What do you like to play? We talked a lot about games, but not like what you actually like playing, apart from obviously, bear related content.
There's a couple of bear things. Well, not recently. I've been straying away from games where I'm playing as bears quite so often, but it's just because I can't find them. They're a little trickier to find than one would imagine. Generally, people like to play as humans for some reason or some variation of that. So I don't get it personally, but to each their own. But no, in terms of what I've been playing recently, I have been thoroughly enjoying a game that I initially got in my current role in terms of like researching titles for like the next projects you're going to be working on in the future. This great game called Potionomics, which is you're a woman, you've moved to a new city, you've inherited your uncle's potion shop, and it's making potions, and economics are involved because you're running a small business, you're making potions and like buying in new ingredients and selling those potions for a profit. And trying to basically pay off the debts that your uncle has incurred on his potion shop. Fantastic characters, fantastic writing. It could do with a bit of work in UI and some of its mechanics. It's a great example of a game where I've played it and I've loved it. And I'm like, usually I play a game, I find it very hard to critique. I'm very like, you give me anything and I'll see the positives in it. And Potionomics is very much that. It does so much right, but I'm kind of proud of myself for saying, actually, if I could get involved, I would do that differently, or I would have this mechanic operate slightly differently, all that kind of thing. So I'm like, oh, my critical eye is starting to improve a little bit, I suppose. But it's a fantastic game. Great representation, as I said, fantastic characters. You can romance anyone. There are options between men, women, demons, walrus people. It's like, hey, look at all these characters, and you do you. Personal shout out to the walrus guy, Muktuk, big, massive, burly, like walrus artist man, very dedicated on making his mark as an artist and finding his way in the creative world. And I'm like, oh, he's just a big dude. He doesn't shy away. He's loud and he's proud and he's got big muscles. I'm like, that's goals right there, just as a character. So naturally, he's the character I'm going to romance. But you're running a small business, but you're building friendships, you're learning about the world. And then ultimately, you're in these competitions to win prize money to keep your shop afloat, where you're selling your potions and going against opponents and trying to, prove that the little sort of bespoke custom mom and pop potion shop, that's fun phrasing. The mom and pop potion shop has more to offer than, the mass produced sort of common health potions as far as the eye can see, and oh, your next day delivery and whatever. Nice little tale about, I guess, about the importance of representation, but also not getting swallowed up by big business, which is very easy to happen. It's something that happens more and more in this day and age, the importance of
Support
small
local
local
businesses.
business. There you
Support
go.
local businesses.
And that's a game I've been playing a lot. Also, to expand on that, I suppose, a little bit, I've gotten strangely back into the world of Borderlands, which I haven't touched off of in years, but I'm trying to make time to play video games online with my friends a bit more, because like my closest friends were my roommates in college. They all qualified to become teachers. There were no teaching jobs in Ireland, so now they all live in the UK. So we don't get to meet up as often as we would have liked, as we envisioned when we were all in college together. Like, oh, we're all going to live together in the future. Great. And yeah, obviously that's not what happened. But we sit down. We've gone from like talking on WhatsApp to we now have dedicated time where we all sit together once a week. We'll hop in. We'll play some Borderlands. We'll do some quests. And like, they're not as like they like video games, but they're more AAA. They're not as, I guess, seeped in the world of games that I am. It's far less likely that they'll catch on to things going on in like the indie space. Like they're predominantly, it's what's on the PlayStation, or maybe occasionally like what's coming out on the Switch. So it's nice to have little games where I can jump in with them and like just, I guess, just hang out. It's Borderlands, you're not thinking too hard about it. It's got a good story, but you're there, you're running around with your friends, you're shooting things, you're screaming, oh God, I've been down, I need someone to revive me, or whatever the case may be. So we've been doing that, and I'm now currently trying to woo them into playing a game called Vermintide 2, which is basically, I would call it, it's Left 4 Dead in the Warhammer universe, and it's still like actively supported by its developers. Instead of zombies, you're fighting like giant rat men, and it's a bit more of a fantasy world. There's a focus on melee combat rather than range. There is ranged options, but the focus is predominantly on like swords and hammers and axes and all that kind of thing. And instead of just humans, you know, there's a mage on your team, there's a dwarf and an elf. So unlike Left 4 Dead, each character actually plays differently, and you have to kind of be aware of how they play and work that into your team's mechanics. So I think it's something they'll enjoy, but it's a bit of a, I'm having to kind of press them to try it, but I think they'll get there. But yeah, nice little breakdown of a few different things I'm playing at the minute.
If I was going to be slightly controversial,
Go for it.
I've played Borderlands 1 and 2, enjoyed it, but like didn't quite love it. I almost would even go as far as say I feel like it's slightly overhyped. And obviously, you know, opinions are subjective, reviews are entirely subjective. I had a great conversation recently with my partner about like what is the purpose of reviews? And like people kind of look at reviews as an objective kind of entity, and like, but it's purely subjective. Which is why I try and step away from is X thing good or bad and say, did I enjoy it? And then does it function? Right? So, my problem with Borderlands was I play a lot of RPGs and I love trying to beat things that are way stronger than I am when I'm underleveled. And Borderlands' answer to that is you now just do zero damage.
Literally
Go
last
level
night.
up. And like, and if you
Exactly,
try and
yeah.
beat something that's too weak, you can't grind because it's like now, no, you earn 2 XP. Go do
If
some new
that.
level. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'll hold my hands up and say Borderlands absolutely has its flaws. My one of my friends, I did a whole thing where I like cloned a character, got him to New Game Plus or whatever, because my friend, his like character save file glitched or whatever, and he lost his character. So he had to start over from level one where we were on level 30, tried to jump in a game with us, and like he was getting obliterated, obviously, in that looter shooter game that it is. So I'm now like last night we were sitting there, I was a New Game Plus, so I was like, look, spend an extra night or two in this with me. I'll just complete quests. You hang out in the background and you know you'll level up because you're in the party with me. And so we've got him from level one to like level 28 in one evening because like I'm
Nice.
on New Game Plus or whatever. But you're dead right. Like we'll be there in fights now, and I'll be like, oh wow, I'm doing like per shot, I'm doing like 2,000, 3,000 damage or whatever. He'll fire a rocket launcher at like a bug and he'll be like, all right, 2 damage. Yeah, we're knocking it out of the park here. So yeah, Borderlands. It's like you've got to play at this level, and if you don't play at this level, tough, go away, go level up, go come back. It is not the friendliest game in that regard. It's not as accessible there where, you know, if you just want to do the main missions or whatever, like the game literally makes you go grind and do some side quests, and like the dialogue of the characters is like, yeah, you should go do something else for a bit. I'm like, what if I don't have the time, you know? But yeah, no, I enjoy the games. Borderlands 1, I thought the story was quite weak. They improved it in 2, but like these are not games. The game is less the focus. Borderlands is a great vehicle for sitting and spending time with my friends, really. Which is something I need to make a bit more of an effort to do, I suppose, because it's the trade-off of remote work, particularly when your neighbors are a field of cows. You know, socializing becomes that much more important when you're kind of removed from society and don't have as much need to go in and interact with humans as you used
Especially
to.
when the field of cows are not going to be great at Borderlands.
Yeah, exactly. Like I've tried, but they just, you know, they try to eat the controller and they'll run away, and it's a whole thing,
Hate to
you
see it.
know?
So do you sort of shift the conversation once more? I kind of always like to ask some sort of fun, sort of more whimsical questions
Go
around.
for it.
Obviously, you know, you're in your role with marketing, and we've talked about some of the great sort of career stuff you've done. But if you had no limitations, you had access to resource, people, all those sorts of things, right? What would you like to do? You have infinite resource, you can access whomever and whatever you want. What's one thing you'd like to do?
Is this specific to games or just in general?
You can do whatever you like. It's just a blue sky project.
If I could do anything, I could. Oh, that's a great question, and definitely something I should have thought about beforehand. But I think like what I would like to do in that vein would be to, as I've said, my sister has had a very positive experience, be getting engaged online and meeting people and making friends. That and like it's a whole separate experience from her having a disability. I'd love to, I suppose I'd love to like make an organization or something that focuses on that a bit more and creates those spaces for people who might have those different needs or whatever to have a space where, you know, obviously it's great to have spaces that specifically accommodate for their needs, but to create social spaces for them where they're not viewed differently because they have those different needs. You know, they can just hop on the voice chat and play a game with people and be friends. And people's first instincts aren't, oh, I'm, you know, I have to watch what I say to this person because, you know, they're different. It's, oh, no, this person is playing the game with me and they're getting involved in the systems and what's involved there. So my sister's had such a positive experience with it. I'm like, I'd love to kind of, as you said, Blue Sky Project. I'd love to like run an organization that caters to that experience for people and like creates those spaces for them where they can get involved.
I mean, that sounds great. I love the sound of it. I love just like, because I think, again, you know, it relates to a lot of what we've said around creating space for people and letting people showcase and you know, be boss. Do you know what I mean? That's the thing. Like, I don't think enough people allow other people to shine. I try and, you know, one of the reasons I do this is I like getting other people on the show and I want to try and make them feel like a rock star. You know what I mean? Like, this is your time to showcase them and let everyone else know why you're awesome. Like,
there you go. Thank you. And then my first instinct is to go, I'm all right now, but these people are awesome.
Well, that ties into my next question really nicely, because I always also like to give my guests the opportunity to highlight anyone or maybe like a small group of people, just a bit of a shout out, someone who you think maybe doesn't get enough credit where they should.
Someone who doesn't get enough credit, easy, me, right? I am the best thing since sliced bread. No, I think
the
without
straight
question,
white guy answer, am I right?
I tell you, you got to commit to the bit. No, without question, I think it makes sense for me at the minute that if I were going to shout out anything, particularly as the social media manager, I'd probably get an earful from Annie if I didn't mention it, is the Social Link Committee. If you're not already familiar, it is a group that has been set up relatively recently. We've been working on it for a while, but we only just recently sort of, became an official public thing. Right now, we're a Discord community. You can find us on Twitter at Social Link Games. Or so should I say X now? I'm not even 100% sure.
Link,
I should really get on that.
The link will be attached to this episode.
Yeah.
It'll lead to the right
appreciate
place.
That. But yeah, you've been interesting to see where that goes in the coming weeks. But yeah, exactly. Who knows? But it's a great space. If you're interested in learning more about games, if you're early on in your career in the games industry, we're a space that is all about getting in, making those connections, making friends, and I guess helping each other through the first couple of years in the games industry where making those connections can be hard. And like that comes from personal experience from all of us. I think the majority of people who are on like the committee that put the group together, we've all been in the games industry maybe a year or two, or maybe three in some cases. Like to give a shout out in particular to people on the team, because I just sing her praises every chance I get. Ellie Pattinson, our community manager, she and I actually like started our careers in the games industry together. We both started in the same company and like worked on projects together and all. Like, she's like my best friend in the games industry. I absolutely love her to bits, and she does such amazing work now. So yeah, while I'm at that, check out Prismatica and Station to Station, which is like a train simulator coming
trains.
To Steam, and it's so
adorable. Trains. Hello.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you haven't heard of it already, check it out on Steam.
Absolutely, like there's no context to that apart from like stuff I've said recently to friends. But like, what joy you take from playing? As I seem to find from trains, I just love games about trains. There's something about just a steam train on a track that brings me so joy.
Like, I'm very excited. Easy wish list for a Station to Station for you then. So, Ellie, great fan of Ellie. She's fantastic. But to bring it back to, I guess, the wider Social Link Committee, like, I guess to name everyone, Ollie and Rosie and Niamh. Delighted to have Niamh on the team. She's English, but she's got an Irish name. So I'm like, no, you're me. You're my group. Same with Ollie. Ollie's surname is Irish. So I'm like, you're hanging with me, pal. We're a group that's all about bringing people in across the UK and Ireland for the minute. We'll see where we go with time. For now, you know, we want to start small, focus on the UK and Irish games industries, bring people in, get them interacting, get them socializing, and just making sure that, I guess, the new people in the industry are equipped to support each other and help each other through, because it can be a difficult industry to navigate, particularly if you lack those connections like we were discussing earlier. So Social Link Committee is specifically, I guess, put together to address and to tackle that. So that's where my shout out is booked to. So.
It's a thing that I really love, and like Annie was on the show a few episodes past, and yeah, they kind of like tentatively like I'm cooking something up, but I can't talk about it right now, and type of thing. And when I saw it sort of go out, I immediately like messaged them and was like, "This is incredible. I want, if I can help in any way, let me know, because I love this. Like the industry needs this. I love it. Thank you for making it. Like, you know." As chairperson, particularly, like, you know, obviously the whole committee do a bit of everything. That's the whole point. But it just felt like something so needed. And I think I'm lucky in that, and this just sounds like an out and out flex, but people have said to me, like, oh, Chris, like you network in a way that makes sense and is appropriate. And that's how I've been afforded to meeting people. I mean, you know, we met at Develop. I feel like I did an okay job at meeting you. And now you're on the podcast. You know what I mean?
There you go. Yeah. It was relatively random, but I mean, we had the mutual connection of Bryn, so you know, yeah, that's how we met and we got chatting. So
yeah,
but I was delighted for the opportunity. You were a pleasure to talk to.
And well, thank you. But like, you know, networking in of itself is hard, and I think it's really easy to either trip over that, like, or like, you know, please notice me, kind of pick me, kind of like overzealousness that can maybe sour the mood. Or like, you know, perhaps like not feeling strong with a bit, oh, by the way, like, yeah, I do this. I love the sound of what you do here. Have a business card or whatever. Like, follow me on
my I would disagree. I love networking. I would say it's the thing I'm probably best at. But I guess my hot tip there in the world of networking is don't go into a conversation with any expectations. Obviously, I mean, if it's a business kind of thing, that's a business discussion. That's a different issue. But if you're just networking and going in to meet people, I guess it comes from being an extrovert. Genuinely love meeting new people and learning about them. I'm a very curious person, so I'll meet someone like, oh, I'm telling you about that, and what are you working on? I mean, you remember me at Develop, I didn't stop asking you questions, I was picking your brain the whole time. It helps to just have a genuine interest in people. Networking can become second nature. I could probably do a whole separate talk on that for people who struggle with socializing and networking and all that kind of thing.
That's one of the things I feel like I wouldn't necessarily, a couple of years ago, I wouldn't have said that, but like, you know, only like, was it last year now? Yeah, like last year, like I went to PAX East in Boston by myself and like only knew people online, and this is going to shock a lot of people, but I just sort of chatted to them about things that we had in common and listened to them, and then it just so happened that then I became friends with these people, and then like, oh yeah, have you met my friend Chris? And like, then that's how you meet more people. Like I really think that tip of no expectations, if you just go and chat mints with people.
Exactly. You'd be surprised how far you can get by treating people and not business opportunities,
what?
I suppose.
Whoa!
Yeah, I know, it's madness. Now, obviously, I think the real issue is people might struggle with socializing or communicating when you're networking and all that kind of thing. And that's a different thing. That is, I can sympathize with that. I can't say I empathize because I love talking to people, but I can sympathize with, like, you know, you just find it harder to talk and communicate with people. I've given like talks on public speaking and like finding your voice and all that kind of thing in the past. It is definitely a bit harder to navigate when you're more introverted as a person. But it is possible. And again, I think that whole no expectations thing is a big part of it. You know, if you're going into a conversation like, oh, I need to talk to a person about this X project or pitching that thing or whatever, you're just going to make a bigger and bigger deal of it in your head until like it's just you're toppled by the weight of it. Whereas if you're wandering around, and I mean, like, if you're an introverted person, because like my other sister, I have two sisters, and my other sister is very introverted. She's blown away by like how social I am, but she'll be much shyer. But she sees great success if she sees like a group of girls on a night out, or some people talking about something that she might be interested in. You'd be surprised how far you can get just by going over and going, oh, hey, you know, I heard you guys talking about this. I'm interested in that. Or I love your dress or shoes or whatever. Where did you get it? You'd be surprised how easy it is to get engaged with strangers in conversation. You just need to like find a point of entry, something that everyone can talk about, even if it's like, oh, man, crazy weather or whatever. But no one is out to get you.
I feel like we should counterbalance that with like, when you're at an event where people know they're going to be talking to strangers, right? Like that. Don't just start randomly talking to people in the street. Maybe that's not super.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. No. Personal safety. Again, male privilege or whatever. Personal safety being a thing. Yeah, no,
but
I do find
like that, you know, develop felt very, very generally very welcoming. You know, they're definitely like space for meeting people, and there was a good facilitation for that. I've seen other things like Games for Change. They had like an online speed networking thing. You know, and I think they then did recreate it in person. I can't confirm that. But the emphasis was that, you know, you go into a setup, you chat with someone 5 minutes, and then you just move on to the next person. You know, just exactly. To like, we are going to facilitate this in a safe and orchestrated manner. So like, if you're not having a great time, it's 5 minutes, it'll be over eventually. And if it's a great time, great, keep in touch. It's tough to balance, I agree. But I think, you know, events that I've been to have definitely felt very welcoming and you know, just, you know, people are really happy to hear about like what you do generally.
Yeah, no, I think we as humans are very curious about the people around us. So I think as long as you go in with that in mind, you know, be curious to learn about the person that you're talking to, and they're naturally going to be curious about learning about you and what you want to talk about as well. So it can be scary, it can be stressful. I used to be quite introverted. But I've done a complete 180 now, and I can't picture myself ever having been introverted, even though that actually was a thing. I was a closet, maybe that's a more appropriate term. Sorry.
I'm very aware of, like, I'm saying this as I'm on my own podcast, but like, I'm described as an introvert that wears a very good extrovert coat. And public speaking is a skill, right? It's a skill, it's something you can learn, get better at, improve at, and then master, right? And a big thing for me is that like I'm still introverted. I still recharge by having time alone. My social battery has its limits, as does everyone's, right? But I think I do enjoy talking to people. I enjoy it. But then, like, you know, like after like an episode or like a stream, I'll then go and like spend an hour by myself just listening to music. You know? I think this psychology now, sorry, psychology hat, research.
Oh, happy to hear it.
People think it's a binary this or this. It's a continuum. You can be in between. You can lean more towards one side, but it doesn't mean that you cannot do either skill set.
Yeah. I mean, in my outside of like mathematical data, like the human experience, I think trying to list anything as binary is dodgy business.
Yeah.
It's just the human brain is so complicated. You know, I think, I'd agree with you 100% there. Yeah, I guess understanding yourself and how you interact with people is important, and knowing, you know, your limits, you know, when you need to go and recharge. I've heard of a spoon system, people using their spoons for the day. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite familiar with that. I'm just aware of the term, but I think it's like you can do X amount of sort of mental labor tasks in the day, and then, you know, you pause it there because it's going to be diminishing returns and start stressing and burnout and all that kind of thing. There are resources out there, I guess, for helping to manage your headspace while you do work or like engage with people, stuff that might tire you out. You know, there are resources out there for you to discover to help you manage that, I suppose. This has gotten into a very like how to cater to people who struggle to talk to people, because I always try to be very aware of that as someone who loves talking to people. But
we love it, practical advice. My sort of last kind of like official question really is, you're going to a biodome of your choice. You're going there for an unlimited amount of time. You can take with you one film, book, album, and game. What are you taking? If it comes as a collection, I'll let you have it. If it's a box set, I'll let you have it. You can have a TV series as opposed to a film, things like that. But what are you taking? Gotcha. Where are you going and what are you doing?
So first off, biodome, I take it we're talking like desert island or, you know,
definitely
tundra,
not a rip-off kind of desert island discs at all. But yes, a biodome. I personally would not go to a desert island because I'm an albino. So yeah, nah, I'm okay. A nice fair misty enough woodland that's not humid. Lovely.
Yeah, that's not too far away from where I live. But funnily enough, the Irish were like afraid of the sun, obviously not to the degree that someone with albinism is, but I live in spite of that. I love the summer, I love sunny weather. I like Annie in particular is like, oh, the sun, oh, they fear it because I guess they're a goth and they wear dark clothing and yada yada. But I'm like, no man, like I rock my Hawaiian shirts no matter what the weather is. So put me on like a sunny island, you know, waves lapping, sun beaming down, seagulls kind of around. I love that sort of energy and that vibe. So that would be my preferred biome. For one film, just a movie I can sit down and watch again and again. Cannot go wrong with the very bombastic, the incredibly well-written Mad Max Fury Road. I absolutely love that movie. the remake now. Like, the original trilogy is great too. It's got its issues. But it being remade, and just like, it had circus performers in it. Like, all the stunts were real and all these like demolitions. And yet it's just, it's a beautiful piece of cinematography in this like post-apocalyptic Australia. It's just one of those movies. I pick it because, you know, it's an island and, you know, I have to rewatch. That's a movie I can sit down and rewatch as many times as I like. And I find I never get tired of it. It's just such a fun movie. So exciting, so engaging. And people can often, in the film society, I suppose, turn their nose down at action movies. I think action movies can have a lot to offer if they're done right. And I think Mad Max Fury Road is a really strong example of that. Because it's like, I mean, female empowerment is such a big theme of Mad Max Fury Road. But I'm not here to sit here and critique film. I don't want to go. I've got other things to give. So Mad Max Fury Road would be my film. Album, again, if I'm going on something I can listen every day again and again. Killers, Sam's Town. Killers was like the first band that made me like stop and go, oh, I like music enough to be like aware of this band. That being said, I love the Killers. It's a love-hate relationship because I love them. I hate them because I blame them for me catching COVID, because I went to go see them perform in Malahide Castle, which is like a big concert venue in Ireland, and I caught COVID after it, and it was my birthday too. So just, a bit of a love-hate thing going on there. But I forgive them. Me and Mr. Flowers, I'm sure we have a very amenable relationship. But Killers, just beautiful music. I'm not going to lie, I've heard people critique the Killers for their lyrics being nonsense. And sometimes they are. Sometimes their lyrics, like, you can read into them as much as you want, and the interpretations of them are loose at best. But it doesn't take away. They've got an image, they've got a sound that just really resonates with me. Like, the imagery they conjure with their lyrics, the kind of, what would you call it, alternative rock sort of energy they put out there. And then when they perform, they're amazing performers. They're very positive, very inclusive. I just think they're a fantastic band and I love their sound. I'm not as much of a music head as I would be like a games or a movie head. So I tend to just default, yeah, I love the Killers, and that's kind of it. Pearl Jam as well. But if I was to pick an album, Killers, Sam's Town. As for a book is tricky because I find I don't reread books. I'll tend to drop a book and move on to the next one, whether it's in a series or a different genre or whatever. But a book, I'll pick the book that probably, I guess, had a really profound impact on me as a carer. It's this fantastic book. And unfortunately, I can't remember the name of the author, but I'm like, if I ever met this guy, because he's still alive and knocking about, I'd love to just like catch him at a convention or something and tell him how much his book meant to me. It's a book called Scala Grigg. And the book is centered around a girl with special needs trying to figure out this mystery of something called Scala Grigg. And it's impactful because her relationship with her father, who like struggles to take care of her but loves her to bits and all the rest of it, very emblematic of my relationship with my own sister and having to care for her and the difficulties that realistically can emerge there. So yeah, the relationship there. There's a character, a prominent character with Down syndrome, and he's not like infantilized like you see people with Down syndrome be infantilized in other media. He's a fantastic character, and this was a book written in like the 80s. So it was very forward thinking for its time, but it bounces between that set of characters and a character, again, with special needs that was like made to live in like basically a mental asylum. I apologize if that's not the correct terminology, but like that sort of 70s, 80s cold hospital corridors, very uncaring staff, all that kind of thing. And they are aware of what Scala Grigg is. And these people, however many decades in the future, are there trying to uncover the mystery behind this person. And funnily enough, the girl very quickly goes on to become a very prominent game designer. So I was like, oh, wow, this book just ends up hitting all my notes or whatever. So it's this beautifully written book. And it like one of the themes, I guess, is disability and accessibility and how it impacts people's lives and the lives of the people that love them around them. So one of the few books I've read and I've like tears have been hitting the page because it was just so emotionally impactful for me.
Talk about life imitating art, am I right?
Honestly, God, there you go. I've never had a book hit me or never resonate more with me personally. And then one video game. It's tough because, again, if we're talking about longevity, I'm nearly kind of wanting to say Baldur's Gate 3 now, even though I haven't played it and hasn't come out, with just the sheer amount of replayability and different choices you can make in that game and all the rest of it. But if I were to pick a video game, this is where I'll lean on your flexibility a little bit. And I will say the Mass Effect trilogy. I am a diehard Mass Effect fan, which is funny because, like, Mass Effect is unabashedly like military worship. It's like, yeah, the military coming in, fighting the aliens and saving the day and yada yada. Absolutely, that's a big aspect of stuff going on there. But and like, whereas that wouldn't be my view generally at all. But I love Mass Effect. I love the universe it's built, the aliens, the different races. It has a whole thing, a whole like theme of the game is organic versus synthetic life. I love robots, all things to do with machinery, circuitry. The character that sort of leads that struggle of the robots being like, we're people too. And, you know, we want our own autonomy and voices to be heard. I have him like tattooed on my arm because he just left such a profound impact on me. So, yeah, so video game, be the Mass Effect trilogy. Not without its faults, but I do love it.
Who do you romance in Mass Effect, though? That's the question.
Oh, I am. When I do female playthroughs, it's got to be Garrus. When in my male playthroughs, God, I wish it was Garrus. He's just such a great character. I suppose if I could pick anyone to romance, I'd pick Legion. I'm a diehard Legion fan. But when I play male Shep, I'll tend to romance Tali. Now and again, I romance Jack. I, out of principle, won't romance Ashley. Never mind that. I won't even save Ashley a lot of the times. I'm like, you're just a racist. There's not really a lot of justify. You can argue that you grow in like the coming games. But I mean, like, Caden's just... Caden gets a lot of hate, but he's pretty solid. He's a really good bro. So, generally I'll romance Tali, or if I'm female, I'll romance Garrus. I play around with it a little bit, but it's one of those things, games where you have all your choices. You go, oh man, I can't wait to go into this game now and make the exact same choices I made the last time. You know, it's one of those. But I'm trying to actively challenge myself now, my most recent playthrough. And I'm actually like going down the path of Renegade and seeing where those decisions take me, which has been an exciting experience. Although there are just some points where, with Renegade, I'm like, it's like, do you want to help this baby or punch it? And I'm like, even though I should pick the Renegade option, I'm like, just in me, I will feel sad if I do it. That'll lessen my enjoyment of it. I'm going to help the baby. Obviously, that's a very extreme example. It's not accurate, but you get what I'm putting down.
Yeah. So, I mean, it caught my eye, and I was going to ask, but is that a Mass Effect poster behind you?
Yes.
Yes, look at me.
If I can alter it. That is I think the term is lithograph or litho something poster. I guess my camera's just here now. That I bought off the BioWare store, and literally I only just got it framed like a couple of days ago. I've had it like just on the wall with a bit of blue tack for a couple of years, but I actually went and got a lovely frame done up for it. And yeah, ordered it from the BioWare store. You can get some great stuff on there. Apparently there are body pillows of like both romanceable and non-romanceable characters. And I'm like, I've never owned a body pillow, but like Garrus and Tali, of course, very popular, but they very recently released Erdnot Rex, who like isn't a romance option, but people love him. So they're like, yeah, maybe. But if there was a Legion body pillow, I'd buy it in a heartbeat. But yeah, no, big, big Mass Effect fan. I've got, actually, if I can continue to geek out, actually, I won't stand up. I'll turn the camera. I've got the Omniblade there,
okay,
and the N7 helmet. As well, just yeah, I'm such a big Mass Effect mark. I can talk about it all day.
Yeah, so thank you for noticing. You would get some mileage out of the trilogy then. Love to see that.
Exactly. Yeah, that would keep me. I would live on that island. I'd retire. I'd set up my group for accessibility, and that would just be. I'd be living my best life. You know.
So one of my sort of truly sort of ultimate questions then is, I like to turn the tables and say, have you got a question for me? Now, I will preface that with, I've had the biodome question, and like, how's your PhD going? Don't ask me that. a couple of times. But like, anything throughout the discussion that you've thought, actually, I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Yes, that is very interesting that you put that forward on a podcast, because that's, as far as I'm aware, that's not as done of a thing. I think that's very creative and clever. I really like it. There you go, and as you should, you know, you deserve to feel a little bit smug. Only a little, don't get too crazy. But Yeah, no, I have, as I said, I was a researcher before I was in the world of marketing. Yeah, to give you a brief tour of my career, I've done everything from retail, research, engineer. I was once involuntarily involved in a gang, like I've worked a ton of different jobs, but that's a story for
What a cliffhanger for a second episode.
there you go. Yeah, if you ever want to bring me back, I'll tell you that story. But and it wasn't even Irish. I was in like LA and they were like a Mexican gang. It was just mad. Oh, it was a whole thing, but I digress. Lovely group of lads. At least when I didn't do anything illegal. I can't clarify that enough. It was
Sorry,
just wild stories from the J1 visa. But
people have like, listen to this episode and then just this absolute chaos of like, so I was in a gang for a bit, didn't do anything illegal, promise, definitely didn't. Lovely lads, lovely fellas.
yeah, it's a very, very sort of mixed bag of responses going on there. But yeah, anyway, as I said, I worked a ton of different jobs as a brief. But I loved academia. I loved doing my master's degree. I am currently sort of in the background talking to a professor about taking up a PhD. Maybe not right away, maybe like something for 2024. I'm kind of exploring my options. I'm building out my proposal at the minute. Academia can really be another field because I used to work, actually, a politician. I used to work for the Union of Students in Ireland, which is the Irish equivalent of the National Union of Students, I think you guys have.
NUS, yeah.
NUS, yeah. And then if you're in Northern Ireland, you have the wonderful NUS USI, which is kind of both and neither. It's a whole thing. But we all play nice together. It's all, we're all the same interests. We're all mad about students. But yeah, I love the world of academia. I'm very interested in, as I said, taking up a PhD. What I would have learned in my time in student representation is that accessibility for disenfranchised backgrounds is a big problem in the world of academia as well. Like it's prevalent everywhere. But I guess what might be a probably, I don't want to say clever, what might be a fruitful question for me to ask you would be, what would be your advice for someone who doesn't have like any awareness of the world of academia, PhD? They don't have those connections, those advantages. If they wanted to get started in that process, maybe that's something you went through yourself, I don't know. But if someone was starting from scratch,
So
what advice would you give them? Because I think that would be helpful.
and this sounds very brutal, and that's and it sounds like a joke answer, but it was something that was said to me by a panel of experts when I had just started my PhD. And truly, look at the job you want first. Do you actually need a PhD? And I say that for several reasons, because one, PhDs in industry, and I've encountered this, this was a feeling that I got to develop. From an industry perspective, they can just see you as someone who just wants to be a student. They want you, oh, you want to be a perpetual student, right? That's not real work, quote unquote. Completely untrue. I work 7 days a week, most weeks. You know what I mean? It's because it's an ever present, it's a labor of love. You know what I mean? So really look at, do you actually need them? Because A, the financial burden, the time, the physical stress, the burden, like, because, it's not just you only do the PhD. Many university programs like give you the option to do teaching. Like my PhD is three pieces of empirical research. I've done a teaching qualification. I had to do physical teaching. So like it very quickly stacks up as like you can have a 60-hour week very, very quickly. So really, really know that that's what you signing up for. And if you need to do it. And I say that because I do need to do it. Like, I truly, to do what I want to do, I need the accreditation to prove I can do research, right? The second tip is then do something that you are passionate about, because that is what will keep you going on the cold, lonely nights, on those rainy Tuesdays, when you care about it, you have to have that drive to say, I want to make change with this. That's why I'm doing it. It's not just like, it's like a great example I heard. I forget the guy's name now. It was just terrible. But it was like, if someone's saying, right, I'll give you £1 million if you write a novel. You think, yeah, that's great. I'll write a novel. And then you get about halfway through and go, nah, I don't care enough to finish it. It's not worth it. The amount of time and effort it's taken. That's where you need that passion to be like, no, I do care. And then the third tip is, the great things about PhDs is that they are largely very accessible in terms of where you do one, especially now in sort of like a COVID accepting world, I'm going to put it. I truly don't think we're post-COVID. But like, unless you are contracted to teach, you could have a supervisor from anywhere in the world, really.
And yeah, work very
and
true.
Meet with them online. Because, you know, you're doing the work yourself. You know, they're there to advise and provide pastoral care and guidance and information. But like, you're the one doing the work and that's kind of on you. So like that, like go to where the expertise is, find someone that you want to work with. I was really lucky in that one of the few people doing games research in the UK happened to be in Merseyside, which happens to be where I live. Very, very lucky with that. And then prepare for several rejections. I was rejected for many years before I got into my PhD. I'd shed many tears because, you know, it's something that I wanted to do for a while. Shed many tears on the PhD as well, but that's a different story. But like, you know, just be like, you'll probably get knocked back a few times before you get a proposal that's accepted. I found that just many universities did not want to bite on games. They didn't see the value in games research, you know. And universities, ultimately, sadly, it comes out of money. Universities saying, is this an investment of our time? Even if you're like a self-funded student, like they'll say like, okay, but what are we going to get out of your research? What metrics will we get? Will this contribute to our research excellence framework output? They're the type of things a uni will think of. So even if you've got a brilliant idea, if they go, we don't really have anyone else publish on this though, it might not help our metrics. They might just turn you down for something silly like that. So don't take that personally. And I guess fourth and final tip is just like, you know, like, don't be afraid to adapt as you go through. Part of the thing I've learned on my PhD is that I went in with these big lofty ideas and these sort of like, yeah, it's going to be this and we're going to do this. And then that got completely chucked out the boat. And you have to adapt. And it's as much a journey about you as it is the research. I've grown as much as my research has grown. And I've worked in industry myself. I've worked in retail. I've worked in public health research. I've worked in outreach. So I have like that, you know, quote unquote, real world experience, or like at least office based experience. And the skills are very similar. Like, you know, being able to just like, right, I'm going to sit down and work for 8 hours is very, very useful. The privilege of a PhD is things like this, where I can just record a podcast episode at, you know, 10 o'clock on a Friday because my time is my own. I manage it. I'm, you know, and then going to do work between this and then I've got other things to do. So being able to manage that, I think, is really important. And this was a lot more information than I'm pretty sure you wanted or anticipated. So I'm now going to stop. But like, yeah, it really is just try and get as good an idea as you can of what you're signing up for.
As I said, I put that question out there for the benefit of people who might not know anything about the academic process. And yeah, no, you make a very good point. And when I was VP for Postgrad Affairs back when I was in USI, I was asked a similar question, like, should people do a master's degree? And people were kind of expecting my answer to be, yeah, you know, I represent postgrads. So obviously, you know, master's degree should be the way to go. People would generally be surprised. My answer was, do a master's degree if you feel that's the right decision for you. You know, if it works within, like, I did a master's degree because my undergrad was in English and art. I had an interest in marketing. So I did bits of marketing work to get the work experience to qualify to do my master's degree, which I then went and put my heart and soul into. And I enjoyed it enough that I'm like, yeah, I could see myself doing a PhD in the future, largely out of interest. So I'd look to do it part time over the course of over a much longer period of time as a sort of self-driven project.
You know? So I really also can't advocate for, if people wanted to do a master's, I would totally say do that part time as well. Doing it in a year is really intense, especially if you.
Oh, it was. Also I treated it as, like you said, 7 days a week. Like, yeah.
And the PhD, like, yo, the traditional program is 3 years. It's very rare people actually finish in 3 years. Really, it's four. A lot of funding is only for 3 years. So you get people like myself that are like, you know, my funding runs out in January. So I'm having to secure employment before then because I have bills to pay. So like there's that as like a demographic to operate around. But I do really think part-time is not championed enough, especially if you have literally any other responsibilities in your life.
Yeah. And that's it. Like, part-time would work for me. You know, I want to keep working. I'm a carer. You know, I have other responsibilities that are going to take priority. It is absolutely something I want to do. But, yeah, I want to do it in my own time, whether it takes me 4 years or 40 years. You know, I do it out of the love of like research and data science and marketing and learning more just about the work that I do. And then I guess like advancing that in like the world of academia as well is a nice bonus. But yeah, no, sounds like we're on the same page.
Yeah, no, as I say, I think it's just like, don't just think YOLO swag and sign up for it.
Oh, God, no.
But like, if it's something that you like, you feel that you have the capacity to do and the passion, definitely do it.
Absolutely.
I'm aware, like, this is like almost like a contentious question now, but like, where can people find you? Obviously, all the links will be attached below wherever you found this episode. But where's the best place for people to reach you?
Yeah, so I mean, for now, X/Twitter/Musk's baby weird project thing. Generally where a lot of people in the games industry congregate. So you can find me there at Gail Gebert, as is visibly displayed. Great place to reach me if you want to reach out and chat to me. Other than that, I mean, that's really it. I would just say I would prop up Social Link Games. The Social Link Committee, our Twitter handle is at Social Link Games, or X handle now, or again, terminology. It's a weird time. But yeah, definitely highly recommend checking that out as well. But if you're interested in keeping up with me in particular, not sure why you would be, but yeah, you can find me at Gail Gebert. I do marketing, as I said, I prefer to be in the background kind of platforming other people. So I don't really have a whole lot to pitch, is the honest answer. I'm happy to kind of create in the background, do my own bits. And yeah, so it's a very boring answer, but yeah, just there, you've got my at on Twitter. You can message me on there if you want to talk to me more or ask me any questions that may can maybe help you with. So yeah.
All right. Well, all it remains me to do is for video viewers, click on the stream ending screen and say, Adam, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate your time and company.
Thank you for having me. It was an absolute delight to be on.
And as we always say on this show, until next time, friends, look after your mind, body, and soul. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. If you did, do please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps. Otherwise, check out the description of the episode for the links for the guest, but also to keep up with information about the show and myself. I really hope you enjoyed this listen. Until next time, take it easy. Look after your mind, body, and soul. And I'll see you again for another episode very, very soon. Bye-bye.